I think we are ready to start this side event. So, welcome, first of all, to everybody. It's an honor for me to open this side event on the important topic, the role, protection, and effective participation of human rights defenders in development. And we're very pleased to co-host this event with International Service for Human Rights. Today's panel includes the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders and the Chair of the Working Group on Business and Human Rights, two mandates sponsored by Norway. And as we will hear, the efforts underway in these two crucial areas, Human Rights Defenders and Business and Human Rights, are closely linked and aim to reinforce each other. Unfortunately, the situation for human rights defenders working on economic, social, and cultural rights has in many areas worsened since the previous report on this topic by the Special Rapporteur. This trend runs contrary to sustainable development. We therefore need to enhance our collective efforts in these areas on the basis of the good work undertaken by the mandate holders. The facts are there before us, and they are cause of grave concern. Before giving the floor to today's moderator and the panelists, let me make a few general points. First, our aim in this area is not to establish new rights or privileges for human rights defenders. As underlined by the GA 2 years ago, human rights defenders can play a substantial role to strengthen development. But at the same time, the GA expressed deep concern for their difficult situation, as they frequently face threats, attacks, and acts of intimidation, which have severe negative impacts on their work and their safety. This is unacceptable under any standards. For this reason, human rights defenders have special protection needs in their work on the basis of non-discrimination and on the basis of the fundamental freedoms and human rights that apply to everyone. Second, governments do not always have to agree with human rights defenders, but they must allow them to speak and allow for an open debate. Fundamental freedoms of expression and association are essential also for the promotion and protection of the more material rights, economic, social, cultural. Creating a safe and enabling environment for human rights defenders should therefore be a fundamental objective of any society. Transparent decision-making and flow of information, accept for differences in views to be heard and for effective participation by various stakeholders in our societies will make for better policy-making processes, which in the end leads to better decision-making, to better decisions, and ultimately to more effective and more sustainable development in the longer term. Third, a human rights-based approach to development requires coordination and policy coherence. And policy coherence starts at home. The work under the two mandates are most relevant also in this light. And this relates to all of us. We look forward to hearing the presentations on these issues here today. But before giving the floor to my colleague here, let me take this opportunity to express our sincere thanks and gratitude to Mr. Margaret Sakagia for her tireless efforts for the defense of human rights over the past 6 years. This will be your final appearance here in New York. And I think it's safe to say that you have had a real impact during a very difficult time for human rights defenders, and also you have moved this whole agenda further through your work. You have worked to give real impetus, traction on the ground under most challenging circumstances, and your recommendations have been a key basis of important UN resolutions. Indeed, we hope to adopt a clear resolution also at this session for the protection of women human rights defenders. So on this note, let me give the floor to today's moderator, Mr. Arvind Ganesha. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'd just like to thank again the Government of Norway and the International Service for Human Rights for organizing this panel today. This is, just by way of introduction, I am the Business and Human Rights Director of Human Rights Watch, and our work frequently touches on issues related to human rights and development. And for me, I see this as a great opportunity today to learn more about the issues from some global experts who've been looking at this issue around the world. So what I'd like to do is just briefly introduce our panel, and then we will open it up first to some questions by me, introductory questions, but we would like to make this an interactive exchange. So we definitely would like to open it up to the floor, and as I understand, we even have people online who may be submitting questions. And I hope over the course of the next hour, hour and a half, we get a real opportunity to discuss one of the critical issues in human rights today. So with that, I'll introduce people from my right to left. And just as a reminder, the chairman of the Working Group on Business and Human Rights will be speaking in Russian today, so we will have translation for that. On my right is Mr. Pavel Sulenziga, the chairman of the Working Group on Business and Human Rights. The working group was a critical step in the evolution of business and human rights and was founded in 2011. And in the course of its work, looking at the new guidelines on business and human rights and under its mandate, one of the things that is highlighted is the role of human rights defenders and also the problem of human rights issues related to development projects. Next to him is Margaret Sekagaya, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders, who we all know and has extensively documented threats and attacks against human rights defenders in the context of development. And we look forward to hearing from her as well today about her experiences and the cases she's working on. And then obviously we have the ambassador, who was kind enough to host us. Thank you again. And then to her left is Cristina Fernandez, who is based in Mexico and focuses on the defense and promotion of human rights, in particular in relation to women. And she'll be providing her experience and perspectives on how issues of development and human rights and human rights defenders interact. And just as an introduction, before I start with the questions, I just wanted to give a brief context of some of the ways that we are seeing these issues come to the fore. And it starts with a basic premise, which is that in today's world, many countries and many individuals are seeking greater development, understandably and justifiably so. At the same time, there are more people in today's world, and there is more pressure on land and resources and competition over them. Inevitably, that will lead to problems, and in some cases, that will lead to human rights problems. And in that context, whether it's a mining project or whether it's a project funded by an international institution like the World Bank, or an agricultural project that requires large use of land for agricultural use, but sometimes will displace communities that were already there, there is an intersection between development and human rights that is undeniable and may be growing. And in that context, human rights defenders are often the first people to point out that there is a conflict occurring, and as a result, may be the first people under threat when it occurs, including the local communities who might be victimized by it. And in a world that is growing on a number of different levels, there is no reason to believe that this will diminish. And that's why it is centrally important to both recognize the phenomenon, but also recognize the people who are highlighting and monitoring these issues. And with that, what I would like to do is just turn it over to the panelists for a question each, and then we will open it up to the floor. So starting with the working group itself, one of the things that the working group has touched upon is potential human rights threats to indigenous peoples in the context of development. And I just wanted to ask a basic question, which is, can you describe some of the circumstances that the working group is seeing around the world that intersect with these issues on human rights and development, but also with indigenous people?
Добрый день, спасибо большое. Я также хотел бы выразить признательность организаторам, правительству Норвегии за организацию такого сайд-ивента. Дело в том, что на самом деле и наша рабочая группа в своем докладе Совета по правам человека это отмечала, что в последнее время очень сильно усилилось давление на правозащитников, на организации людей, которые защищают права человека, будь то это общины коренных народов, будь то местное население или люди, которые страдают от деятельности бизнеса. И поэтому на самом деле очень важно сегодня рассматривать и поднимать этот вопрос в силу того, что таких нарушений становится все больше и больше. Что касается моего доклада, который я от имени нашей рабочей группы вчера представлял, посвященный вопросам прав коренных народов и бизнеса, я хотел бы еще раз отметить, я об этом вчера говорил, что коренные народы в какой-то степени стоят как бы на передовой между развитием, между предпринимательской деятельностью и теми землями и территориями, на которых сегодня живет население. Дело в том, что сегодня экономики многих стран развиваются за счет добычи природных ресурсов. А в основном, эта добыча природных ресурсов приносит огромные доходы и прибыли как для государства, так и для компаний. И многие территории, на которых живут коренные народы, как раз являются богатыми такими природными ресурсами. И мы хорошо понимаем, это известно из определения, международного определения ООН, кто такие коренные народы. Это народы, которые имеют тесную связь с землей. С разрушением этих земель, этих связей происходит разрушение самих народов. И поэтому мы на своем заседании рабочей группы приняли решение как раз посвятить тему исследования, связанной с правами коренных народов и бизнеса. Сегодня, к огромному сожалению, эта проблема становится очень и очень большой. При этом я хотел бы со своей стороны отметить, что международное сообщество, в том числе Организация Объединенных Наций, предпринимает очень много усилий для того, чтобы соблюсти права человека и права коренных народов. Я хотел бы в этой связи отметить принятие Декларации ООН о правах коренных народов. Работа над этой декларацией шла более 17 лет. Я хотел бы также сказать, что сегодня в рамках системы ООН учрежден постоянный форум ООН по вопросам прав коренных народов. Есть специальный докладчик и есть экспертный механизм по правам коренных народов. То есть это те органы ООН, которые стараются наблюдать, мониторить и помогать коренным народам соблюдать свои права. Я также хотел бы сказать о том, что одним из очень важных действенных механизмов защиты прав коренных народов является то, что сегодня рядом крупнейших финансовых институтов мира, такие как Всемирный банк, Европейский банк реконструкции и развития, Межамериканский банк, Международная финансовая корпорация и другие, в своих внутренних директивах и политиках принимают решения по соблюдению прав коренных народов. Это является огромным рычагом именно защиты прав коренных народов. Сегодня у нас есть уже примеры, когда мы видим, что крупнейшие компании ведут переговоры с общинами коренных народов по тому, как, на каких условиях, при каких условиях компании будут разрабатывать те или иные проекты на территориях коренных народов. Компании это делают не потому, что вот они такие хорошие, ласковые, пушистые. Они пытаются получить кредиты из этих международных финансовых институтов, и поэтому они соблюдают права коренных народов и ведут такие переговоры. И поэтому я думаю, что очень важно распространять вот эти политики не только среди международных финансовых институтов, но и в том числе среди частных финансовых институтов, частных банков, частных фондов, которые финансируют те или иные проекты по всему миру. Я думаю, что это касается не только коренных народов, или должно касаться коренных народов, должно касаться всех людей, которые подпадают под влияние тех или иных проектов, будь то местное население, сотрудники компаний и другие люди, живущие на территориях этих проектов или которые будут подвергаться этим проектам. Поэтому я считаю, что люди, которые на своих плечах несут скажем так, стражу, наверное, да, по защите прав человека. Я имею в виду, в первую очередь, правозащитников и правозащитные организации, конечно же, нуждаются в том, чтобы их поддерживали, их защищали. Они также нуждаются в защите сообществ, потому что, в первую очередь, они на себе первым принимают те вот удары, да, которые сегодня имеют место быть со стороны нарушающих организаций.
The question to the special rapporteur on her report, and in particular that she noted that human rights defenders in large-scale development projects face some serious threats, including physical threats, when they highlight problems related to them. And I was wondering if maybe you could elaborate more on some of the cases and circumstances when that's occurred.
First of all, thank you very much for organizing this panel around my report on large-scale development and the effect it has on human rights defenders. I want to thank Norway for continuously helping and supporting my mandate, and ISHR for their efforts to take into account many of the reports which I've presented, either to the General Assembly or to the Human Rights Council. Over the past 5 years, which I've been a special rapporteur, I've seen a worrisome trend of violations against human rights defenders who work on large-scale development projects. If some of you remember, at one time I presented a report here on the issue of non-state actors and the effect it had on the work of human rights defenders. And still, subject like that came up about defenders working on large-scale projects. Human rights defenders working on these projects are usually targeted. They are harassed, they are threatened, they are intimidated, sometimes they are killed, both by state and non-state actors. And in many instances, you find that those who are affected most are those working on land issues or issues of natural resources and environment. And these targeting and threats do not spare women human rights defenders, who are usually very vulnerable in these circumstances. So women human rights defenders, in addition, suffer even more threats and intimidation, but also on top of that, you find particular abuses which are carried out against women, like sexual abuse, rape, and very serious crimes against them. In many instances, we've documented at our office instances of some of the examples of some of these issues which have come out. And I can give you a few examples. In Azerbaijan, there was a journalist and a reporter who was attacked and beaten unconscious by state oil company security staff when he filmed a confrontation between security staff and residents whose houses were being demolished to develop oil resources. His brother and colleagues were also attacked. And you can see how human rights defenders really suffer in these instances. In Guatemala, a case involving mining, there was an attempted killing of a woman human rights defender, who is also one of the most prominent activists of a community initiative in the local inhabitants, who was defending their area on environmental issues, again by the expansion of the mining activities, the perpetrators attempted to kill this woman, human rights defenders. In Thailand, this was involving plantation. There were killings of two members of the peasant movements who were involved in land rights disputes between their community and a palm oil company in the vicinity of their village. Their community was previously targeted with violent incidents, including threats and intimidation, believed to be linked to their land rights activities, and the perpetrators were unknown. During my mandate, I've also been traveling a lot and going for country visits, and some of the countries which I found serious challenges, like in Honduras, those who were working on land issues, environmental issues, were particularly targeted, and it was a serious concern, which I put in my report, for people working on land rights in Honduras. India also has problems on issues of the construction of dams, and you find that access to information and people working, indigenous people, and particularly people living in those areas, are usually ignored when these particular big projects are being carried out. And anyone trying to bring out issues of human rights defenders and opposing the projects are sometimes accused to belong to Maoists or to belong to the opposition, to be opposing government developments. So these are serious cases which usually come out to which affects the work of human rights defenders. And there are many more in different countries in the Inter-American region, as you know, and some of the other countries coming up in Africa, which involve oil, extraction of oil, where defenders are basically targeted. But the major problem is the fact that when the government is initially planning these projects, that the people are not well ahead consulted, and they do not participate in the design and in the impact assessment of these projects. And you'll find that in later on, the government then comes to take action and tell people either to move or that they should be compensated to leave. And you find that the actual participation of the people has not been there at the initial stage. And for those who have read my report, you'll find a big recommendation on the fact that defenders and the communities should be consulted at every stage of the project, at the design of the project, at the implementation, and at the monitoring and evaluation to avoid these particular problems. Issues of non-discrimination come in to take into account very vulnerable people, as I've already pointed out. Issues of women should be taken into account because most of them depend on this land. That's where they get their livelihood. That's where they live. That's where they get all their resources. So these are some of the issues that defenders, sometimes, as I've said in the report, are even accused of being anti-development, of being against the government, just because of the work they do, just because of the opposition they have against these projects. But we have to find a solution, and the solution is participation, transparency, non-discrimination, and ensuring that the human rights defenders and those affected are consulted at every stage.
Thank you so much. Christina, your organization is a founding member of the Mesoamerican Women's Human Rights Defenders Initiative and works to protect women from violence and other abuses. Now, in the context of development, what kinds of challenges are you seeing in the course of your work?
Muchas gracias. First, I want to thank the invitation on behalf of the JAS Association. and for the Mesoamerican Initiative for being here. We are overwhelmed with the invitation, and of course it's a privilege for us to being here. Regarding the first the question, I will start with one phrase that I found in the report of Oxfam that says that in the region, more than 60% of the world's poorest people live in countries rich in natural resources, but they rarely share in the wealth. Oil, gas, and mining projects can have significant impacts on host communities and the environment. Large-scale resource projects offer the potential to bring opportunity for citizens of the nations where the resources are being developed. Unfortunately, the poorest and most vulnerable communities, in many cases, including indigenous communities, often are excluded from these benefits that might be generated by these activities and are the communities most burdened by the costs. Too often, communities have no say in this decision or whether the two extra resources from their land and receive little information about these projects. In regions like in Latin America, the transition of democracy has not been consolidated, giving rise to new forms of authoritarianism and militarization. Civil protest has increasingly been criminalized, freedom of expression restricted, and opportunities for citizen participation in policy making is limited. In this context, powerful non-state actors, such as religion hierarchies, organized crime, and transnational business monopolies, have gradually increased their influence and control over public authorities and institutions, as well as over the decisions they make. Explicit death threats against women human rights defenders are the principal form of violence in the region, according to the UN Special Rapporteur of the Situation of Human Rights Defenders. In the last year, the Mesoamerican Initiative has tried to present the faces of the women who are facing these threats. We found in a diagnostic made in 2012, we registered 414 attacks committed with women human rights defenders. 40% of them were women who work in rural areas, and we found out that these are the particular regions where the human rights defenders receive the most aggressions. The other rest is in the urban areas. We found out also that the women human rights defenders who receive the most threats are the ones who are denouncing mega projects, who are organizing the communities or organizing their families to defend their lands. Who are these women? They are women in mostly communities indigenous who are not getting paid for the work they are doing. There are women who are defending their territory, defending their life, and defending our environment. These women have families and are working hard to denounce the lack of transparency of the government and the companies that are trying to implement projects in their communities. It is important to note that all NOR attacks are registered, and sometimes the problems that women human rights defenders face are the possibilities to denounce and to inform to other organizations and to state actors what is happening in their communities. It's remote zones, regions that we cannot sometimes imagine, or we are forgetting about the situation they are facing. So finally, to give space to the discussion, we would like to say that one of the most concerning issues that we are facing now is the mining projects. This is a big issue in the whole region, and it's causing a lot of social conflicts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right, that also that the government of Norway has submitted a resolution on women human rights defenders for the third committee, and I wanted to highlight that both in the context of this session but also in general as well. So thank you for that. We are webcasting this session, So I'd like to open it up to the floor, if possible, for questions. And I would just ask that as you ask questions, please introduce yourself and your organization as well. So I'll first go to the floor, and Madeline will be monitoring online in case we have some interesting questions coming up online as well. So I'd like to open it up to the floor to ask our experts any questions related to human rights defenders and development. Right there, please.
Thank you for this presentation. I've been listening with great interest. My name is Jocelyn Medayo, and I'm with the Center for International Environmental Law. So I'd like to make a comment and then ask a question. So first I want to say that together with partners, including International Accountability Project, the International Network for Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, and Human Rights Watch, we are launching a global campaign to ensure that development finance respects human rights. And I've been quite interested in this discussion because one thing that we're promoting is the use of human rights impact assessments in development finance projects. So our primary focus for our global campaign that we're launching right now is the World Bank, so public sector finance, because the bank is undergoing a review of its environmental and social safeguard policies, which are global standards. One other thing that the bank is doing is they have recently launched a strategy, a World Bank Group strategy, and it pretty much says that the bank will be increasing risks. It has a need to increase risks, that it will be increasing and deepening interventions in fragile conflict-affected states. So these are the states by the very definition, present the most challenging development environments. Poor governance, political instability, and frequently continuing violence from a legacy post-conflict. The World Bank is also saying that they, through this strategy, that they will increase the need for large transformational projects, large development projects. So this raises a concern for us because if not managed effectively, this can really result in serious human rights risks and violations. So my question is, in the context of public finance, what are the panel's opinions on how to ensure the protection and effective participation of human rights defenders in, like, World Bank projects moving forward? Thank you.
Since the chair of the working group mentioned the role of international financial institutions, maybe I'll ask you if you have some thoughts on that first.
Спасибо большое. Я, к сожалению, не очень хорошо понял вопрос.
Sure. So basically the question was, how can the development banks, the World Bank and others, better protect human rights and incorporate human rights impact assessments, for example, into their work?
Спасибо большое за этот вопрос, но вы в своем выступлении сказали о том, что, например, сейчас Всемирный банк работает над изменением своей политики, внесением их новых там, дополнений и изменений. Я со своей стороны могу сказать, например, что Всемирный банк, в принципе, неплохо организовал консультации с коренными народами для учета мнений и идей, предложений от коренных народов. Со своей стороны я хотел бы сказать, что когда мы давали, делали отчет для Совета по правам человека и давали рекомендации разным стейкхолдерам, начиная с государств, компаний, финансовых институтов и гражданского общества, один из наших рекомендаций был это способствовать институциональному усилению деятельности правозащитных организаций. И мы считаем это очень важным, потому что, как уже вот в своей вводной речи и я, и Маргарет говорили, что правозащитники в последнее время все больше и больше подвергаются угрозам и насилию со стороны, в том числе и бизнеса. И поэтому я думаю, что при рассмотрении и продвижение разного рода проектов со стороны таких финансовых институтов, но я думаю, что не только финансовых институтов, но если вы, ваш вопрос касается их, я думаю, что необходимо, чтобы в рамках тех социальных программ, которые существуют в этих финансовых институтах, мне кажется, было бы важно развивать программы по развитию правозащитной деятельности, усилению их потенциала и возможностей.
Margaret, about a variation on this issue, which is there a way for the multilateral banks, say the World Bank, to take steps to better protect human rights defenders as they finance projects around the world?
I think if you read in my report, you realize that I've strategically mentioned that if you handle this issue, you must introduce a human rights-based approach. And what does the human rights-based approach entail? Because that's when you will be able to protect everyone. First of all, a human rights-based approach brings in the issue of consultation, of participation, of the communities, of human rights defenders, at the initial design of the project, as I said. The issue of participation is a human rights issue. Then the issue of transparency. So all at every stage when you are drawing up the agreements, all those should be on the table. People should know what is in those agreements, the contracts, the subcontracting. Who is going to do it? How are they going to do it? How does it affect the communities? And how will they benefit from those projects? The issue of access to information. The defenders and the communities should know. They should be able to access this information. As you know, most of the countries, they think that this information is only for the government and the contractors or the big companies. But the communities should know what is there. There must be transparency, there must be access to information. And then there must also be ways of redress. In case any complaint, the communities need to make any complaints if they have issues about the project. What are the mechanisms in place to receive these complaints? How are they being handled? Are the violations being addressed? Are those perpetrators being brought to book? Are they being prosecuted if they are violations? Are there investigations which are being carried out and they must be prompt and impartial? So that at every stage you have someone handling the issue. If there is any complaint, then you bring it up and there are mechanisms. So you have to strengthen these mechanisms which are looking at addressing the violations. And then there must be a remedy in case a violation has been carried out. So if you bring the perpetrators to book, is there a remedy? Are the mechanisms, whether judicial or administrative, in position to give remedy to the violations which are carried out? And maybe lastly, it's important for the communities, for the defenders to be understood. So their role and the part they are playing in the whole process should be made known to government officials, to policymakers, if it's for exercising, for example, freedom of assembly, if they want to protest, are those security agencies trained in handling these issues so that they don't use excessive force? Because of course, you know, once these projects come up, people protest. They want to exercise their rights to denounce the project or to air their views. So are these security agencies trained on how to handle these people? So these are all the issues which under a human rights-based approach to carrying out such a project.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Christina, building on that, and then we have a question from online. In your experience, we know, for example, that the International Finance Corporation right now is investigating a situation with an agribusiness company in Honduras. But in your experience, working with women's human rights defenders, do you see a role for the multilateral development banks, or do you see where their policies or practices need to be stronger?
In the interviews we are having with most of the women human rights defenders who are facing aggressions in contexts where they are denouncing the companies or state non-state actors imposing mega projects, we found out that it's very complicated to link the periphery with the central. So most of the cases, the problem is that locally, what is happening, the aggressions and the corruption that some companies are making in the communities doesn't easily get out. So, for instance, the World Bank or the Inter-American Bank normally does not know really what is happening in the field. So one of the challenges, it's been what mechanisms do we have to make so this company, so the international finances can go and see really in the field what is happening. The second one is that impunity is really one of the most problematic elements in the context. Locally and nationally, the organizations that are denouncing face the problem that they will not have guarantees if they go and denounce what is happening. So impunity has been contributing to an increased number of attacks and threats and other violations against human rights defenders. So one of the other elements that we are trying to integrate in the analysis, and that it has to be a responsibility also of the companies and for the financials, how to assure that the judicial system is effective in the denounce of these aggressions.
A question from online from Phil Lynch from the International Service for Human Rights in Geneva, and I'll pose it to the chairman. Do the UN guiding principles need to be strengthened to better protect human rights defenders when they're working on issues related to corporations?
Вы, наверное, знаете, может быть, кто следит за темой вопросов прав человека и бизнеса, о том, что на последней сессии Совета по правам человека ряд государств во главе с Эквадором вышли с предложением о том, чтобы разработать международные обязывающие документы в области прав человека и бизнеса. И сейчас мы в рабочей группе будем рассматривать это предложение. Я хотел бы сказать, что с группой друзей нашей рабочей группы мы ведем также постоянные консультации. У нас есть достаточно неплохие взаимоотношения с неправительственными организациями, поэтому я думаю, что, конечно же, усиливать это направление на международном уровне очень важно.
Before I go back to the floor, I just wanted to ask if either of our panelists wanted to weigh in on the question at all.
Strengthening
the guiding principles for human rights defenders.
I think before strengthening the guiding principles, we really need these principles to be more disseminated, more known to human rights defenders. I know that the Working Group on Human Rights and Business has set these principles, but I must confess that if I go around meeting defenders and people in governments, I don't think they are all well known to human rights defenders. So the first thing I would think about before strengthening, we look at them and see they're already applicable, they talk about the best practices, is how do we get them be known to the policymakers, to the corporations, to the human rights defenders themselves? And I think they should also be translated in the language that human rights defenders understand, so that they will be able to know this is what's available to us, which we can use as a tool in our demanding for our rights. As well as the governments also, we should make sure that when they are designing these projects and contracts, they take cognizance of the fact that these guidelines are available and they should be taken into account. So the first thing is dissemination, translating, simplifying, putting them in the language that the defenders understand and that the governments also follow them.
Абсолютно согласен с Маргарет. Я хотел бы также здесь вот упомянуть о том, что мы недавно получили предложение от организации, которая объединяет коренные народы Азии, с предложением о том, чтобы перевести руководящие принципы, кажется, на 42 языка коренных народов Азии. Наша рабочая группа поддержала этот проект. И я очень надеюсь, что мы, нам удастся вместе с коренными народами Азии реализовать этот проект для того, чтобы руководящие принципы были переведены на языки, в том числе коренных народов мира.
Any comments? Then the floor for any questions. Back there, please. And please remember to introduce yourself and your organization.
My name is Kamal Fahmi. I am from Set My People Free. I'm thankful for this opportunity here. And I also was very impressed by the leverage you use for this with land development and so on. And my wish that this kind of leverage and pressure on government will be used also for freedom of thought and conscience. Because actually, one of the what hinders development is very much freedom of thought and conscience and belief. But I'm thankful at least you are doing it in this area. And my recommendation, if we can have some kind, the same kind of leverage for freedom of thought and conscience, will be tremendous.
Thank you for that. Thank you. I will see if anybody would like to speak to that. Otherwise, I will go back to the floor as well.
We still have different mandate holders dealing with such issues. So I think early this morning, there was the special rapporteur on freedom of religion and conscience and all that, and he usually holds very interesting panel discussions. I feel maybe you should also take advantage of his panel discussions. He really goes into those issues, and you'll see that you might find them also very useful.
I'll open to the floor. Does anyone?
On the opportunity, my name is Budi Henawan from Franciscan International, and we work with our partners, in particularly in Asia and Latin America, who encountered confronting with the problem with large corporations. And from the ground, we discovered kind of major patterns in regards to corporations and introduction to business and states. First, most corporations have operated for decades in the area of indigenous people communities. So in the question about consent and prior or participation is rather recent. When they started their operations, those language did not exist first. Second, in many contexts like in Indonesia and the Philippines, India and Honduras, for example, we found that major corporations constitute large taxpayer in those countries. So states have very big interest to keep them in safe. And national legislation don't really allow the human rights defenders in the local level or indigenous community to really confront that reality. So my question to the panel is, in that kind of context, how do you ensure the compliance of states and corporations to really protect human rights defenders in this situation? Thank you.
Let me start with Margaret to see if she has any thoughts on the matter.
Yes, it's true that some of the developments have been ongoing, but at the same time, for example, I'll give you the example. I made a country visit to India, and there are many new projects, building dams, construction. So it's not too late, even if some of the projects have been already going on, to really inject in these new values, these new ideas from the UN and from the special rapporteur, and things we are trying to tell governments to do. It's not too late, because development is always ongoing. And when do you improve? And defenders are now also coming up and demanding for their rights before a government will come and dictate, here we are going to start this project and we want to move you, we want to evict people from this area. But it's no longer the case, because now human rights defenders and the indigenous populations and the communities also know their rights. I want to give you an example. I was in South Korea very recently, and the government had started a project on nuclear power, and they started building the pylons, the big pylons, from a long distance coming, approaching the communities. And then when they reached where the communities were living, they said, we are going to build the pylons. And the communities said, no, you are not going to build these pylons, because we do agriculture, and our agriculture, we have to do irrigation by air. They use helicopters to irrigate their gardens, and once you build those pylons, we will not be able to irrigate our gardens, and therefore this is our livelihood. And the government was stuck, because they were going to lose trillions of money to stop the project. And here they were in the middle of the project. They had already partially built the project, and they could not go on. Every day the defenders went and sat in that place and camped and refused to get the government to go on with the project. So does the government want to get in such an instance where it's going to lose because it couldn't go on with the project? Every day there were protests. The police were there guarding and tear gassing the people. And I don't think this is what they want. So the best thing is to take into account the human rights-based approach. Consult, involve people right at the initial stage of the project. Ensure that people understand the project. We do not want to say that defenders are against development, but we want them to understand that the project is also going to benefit them, or it's going to take into account their issues. If it's an issue of eviction, Where are these people going to be reallocated? What are the issues which come into play? So this is what it is. Development is always going on, and it has never stopped. Even if these big companies pay a lot of taxes, but you don't do it at the expense of the communities, of their livelihood. What are the issues these big companies taking into account? What strategies, what arrangements do they have for these people, where they are going to do mining, where they are going to put dams? How are the people going to live? You don't just ignore them just because the government is going to get big taxes. The taxes are for the people, rights are for the people, and projects are for the people, not for the government.
Thank you. I'll turn to Christina and then the chair if you have any thoughts on it.
Just to say that I think that in the last years, the social movements and the NGOs who are working in regions like in Latin America, for example, with mega projects exclusively, they found out that they have allies like the Inter-American Commission or the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which are beginning to be now the replacement of the judicial system in nationally, that it's not working or it's not responding when they are denouncing the imposition of mega projects. So I believe that these resolutions are making a new framework for other regions. And also, I understand, recently in Canada also, there was a new resolution against Guatemala in the companies, and it's been very impressive the impact that it's going to have for the region. So what I'm trying to say is that there are new tools that are working for the region, and it will be important to disseminate more and more. And I believe that in some time this will be the locks from these companies who are believing now to work with more impact.
I wanted to add something, just giving you some of the best practices, which I also mentioned yesterday during my interactive dialogue. At the national level, Australia developed a Mining for Development initiative, which incorporated environment and social safeguards, as well as criteria for managing the impact for vulnerable groups and the assessment of direct benefits for communities. And again, also in my report, I mentioned Colombia, where the National Hydrocarbon Agency is required to spell out the methodology used to assess the impact of a project in effect, taking into account the community and the way the project will benefit the communities. So some of these things, as you see, you have to look at the best practices of others. And there is also positive initiatives. Often they do not require human rights approach or methodology, but they are used in impact assessment. There is, for example, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. This is a multi-stakeholder initiative. And this is used also to contribute in changing corporate culture and practice. And it offers interesting lessons learned. It will be good to look at the best practices and see what do other countries which have those projects, how do they handle their issues? How do they get on to take into account community issues, cultural issues, instead of just dictating and thinking that the large companies should do whatever they want? It's very important that they look at best practices.
Спасибо большое. Спасибо за ваш вопрос. Я хотел бы здесь поделиться также своим личным опытом. Я вообще начинал свою политическую карьеру как человек, который начал бороться за права своего народа, своей общины, как раз против того, что нашу землю, нашу территорию общины отдали южнокорейской компании Hyundai на 30 лет. Это было еще в советское время, в 89 году. Я хотел бы сказать вот о чем, что мне кажется, для того, чтобы все-таки на самом деле понимать свое движение вперед, мне кажется, очень важно повышать потенциал общин, повышать потенциал коренных народов. Потому что, к огромному сожалению, очень часто наши народы, наши коренные народы относят то к бедным, то к слабым, то к экологам, то к уязвимым группам и так далее. Но все мы должны хорошо понимать, что в первую очередь коренные народы – это субъекты международного права. И я, например, вам приведу просто несколько примеров, да, что очень часто, в том числе, вы говорили о том, что крупные компании являются основными организациями, которые платят налоги, из которых формируется бюджет. И это правда. Да? И поэтому очень важно понимать, чего хотят коренные народы. Хотят ли они остановить этот проект, или не хотят его развивать, или, может быть, они хотят другого. Я, например, приведу вам пример, когда по Канаде. 17 лет шли переговоры по проекту, который предполагал строительство трубопровода. Это строительство трубопровода, кажется, должно было пройти по 7 или по 8 землям индейцев и инуитов. 17 лет шли переговоры по этому проекту, это проект «Долина реки Маккензи», и в итоге крупнейшие мировые компании, транснациональные корпорации, такие как ExxonMobil, Shell и так далее, договорились до того, что создали акционерное общество, которое стало хозяином этой трубы. И я сейчас точно не помню, кажется, 39% этого акционерного общества стало принадлежать самим индейцам и инуитам. Из 11 членов совета директоров 4/4 являются представителями коренных народов. Это один пример. Другой пример я могу привести, когда на Сахалине в Российской Федерации начал осуществляться многомиллиардный проект на шельфе. Там десятки миллиардов долларов этот проект был. И столкнулись интересы промышленных компаний, крупнейших всемирных промышленных компаний и коренных народов. Там противостояние дошло до того, что коренные народы стали перегораживать дороги и не пускать машины для того, чтобы они строили там объекты на землях коренных народов и так далее. И в итоге компания села за стол переговоров с общинами коренных народов. И сегодня компания Сахалин Энерджи, которая является оператором этого проекта, она в своей, я вчера приводил по ней пример, она сегодня является одним из стандартов, как нужно работать компаниям с коренными народами. Во внутренней политике этой компании записана статья из Декларации ООН о правах коренных народов, статья, в которой говорится о предварительном, осознанном, информированном согласии коренных народов. А начиналось все с противостояния. И последний, я вам приведу пример со своей общины. Вот я сказал, в 89 году, когда нашу территорию отдали южнокорейской компании Hyundai, у нас началось противостояние, нам удалось отбиться от этого проекта, и только в 2008 году мы официально получили закрепление нашей территории, официальный документ правительства Российской Федерации, что эта территория взята нами в аренду на 49 лет нашей общиной. Более того, мы в итоге, буквально в сентябре месяце этого года, мы настаивали на том, чтобы на нашей территории никакая промышленность не развивалась. Мы категорически против того, чтобы развивать какую бы то ни было промышленность. А на нашей территории огромные залежи угля, золота, там нетронутая уссурийская тайга, огромные леса. И в итоге мы настаивали на том, чтобы эта территория была объявлена территорией охранной, природной. И в итоге в сентябре вот этого года, чуть больше месяца тому назад, администрация президента России приняла решение о том, чтобы нашу территорию объявить такой территорией природного наследия, полностью ее сохранять, не развивать там никакие промышленные проекты. Единственное, мы сейчас ведем переговоры с администрацией президента России о том, чтобы эта природная территория полностью управлялась нашей общиной. Я считаю, почему это происходит? Вот здесь их успешных примеров, к сожалению, не очень много, но, по моему мнению, этих примеров не очень много, в том числе из-за того, это, конечно же, не главный фактор, наверное, и не единственный фактор, но он является одним из важнейших. Это то, что потенциал коренных народов очень низкий, его нужно улучшать, его нужно увеличивать, поднимать образовательный потенциал, ну и другой потенциал коренных народов, чтобы они могли сами принимать решения в тех процессах, которые происходят вокруг их жизни. Спасибо.
Thank you very much. I have a question here online that's actually a pretty provocative question, so I'll ask Christina to answer it first. It's from the UN Department of Public Information and the NGO Relations Office. And the question is, how can NGOs step up the pressure on violations against human rights defenders working in this context when such violations are increasing? And this is a question I'm tempted to throw out to the audience too, because I'm sure there are a lot of opinions on it, but I'll stick with the panel initially.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. How can NGOs step up the pressure on violations against human rights defenders as those violations are increasing?
Well, it's complicated. My job is at risk now, so. Well, I think that initiatives like the Mesoamerican Network and other organizations are working to be very close to human rights defenders who are at risk. We are trying to make more coalitions and denouncing what is the particular situation. We are also innovating, and works like the International Service for Human Rights that are innovating the ways of presenting the information and the impacts on the local scenarios, it's helping to show what is really happening. I think one of the obstacles is trying to present the reality of how the companies are working in the regions where the projects are trying to be installed. The second is that how we can assure that the impact of, we are talking a lot of the aggressions and attacks that human rights defenders suffer, and particularly women human rights defenders suffer also. But the problem is, what about the prevention and what about the protection in these moments? Because it's been quite a problem in the last years that the impacts of the aggression in human rights defenders is that they cannot still work in the regions. So they have to go out of the countries, they have to change their way of life, they have to, and this is having a really impact in the work that they are doing, and it's making facilitating the process for the companies and for the states. And I would like to make a parenthesis in this one, because I believe that the resolution now gives an important framework to this, to achieve a better goals for the protection of women human rights defenders who are working in this context. And finally, something I believe that it's complicating all the measures that we can achieve is that it seems that when we talk about this issue, it appears a conflict of interest between the state and the companies. And for NGOs and for human rights defenders, finally, the responsibility to protect is from the states. So we need to continue pressuring that the implementation of effective measures for protection has to be done by the states. And the companies also have to be responsible, but at the same time, NGOs can work with the states to facilitating and to guarantee better conditions.
Do either of you have, would you like to?
Я буквально два слова хотел бы добавить. Я думаю, Кристина очень правильно сказала. Первое, что мне кажется, в чем сила гражданского общества, НПО, это в открытости и публичности. Я думаю, что именно открытость и публичность процессов, которые ведут НПО, является их силой, потому что к огромному сожалению, да, силы, которые, ну, скажем так, играют нечестно, они стараются всю игру пускать под столом. И вот для того, чтобы побеждать, НПО должны эти процессы вытаскивать на стол, наружу, чтобы было открыто и прозрачно. Это первое. И второе, Кристина тоже в своем выступлении сказала, это необходимость создания коалиций. Например, коренные народы очень часто или практически всегда находятся в коалиции с правозащитными организациями и экологическими.
Just to add on what the others have brought up, I think every time the human rights defenders are faced with such repression, difficult times, They don't give up. You don't give up. You just have to strategize on what else can you do. At the national level, as we talk, we need to do more. We need, for example, education. We need to sensitize our governments. We need to put more pressure on our governments. But we need also, as civil society, to learn to use the regional and international mechanisms which are available to us. If we are going to do that, we need to learn to document and report. Once you document, you report, then you bring up these issues at the international or regional level. And I think I've seen the pressures sometimes from the international level really working on particular countries. If we are going to get concerted efforts from the international level, put pressures on some of the governments. And they learn from each other too. And I must say, with the introduction of the Universal Periodical Review, where countries are being reviewed and some of these issues are brought, I would encourage civil society to ensure that some of these issues see their way into the reports which come up at the United Nations, so that when the country is being reviewed, it's made accountable, and it makes its voluntary pledges of some of the things it's going to do, and one of them will be to really take into account some of these issues. So participate in those activities, get the Universal Periodical Review, get your reports, get your thematic reports to the treaty bodies. So it will be good for you to learn to use the mechanisms so that these mechanisms can be used within your states to put pressure. And I've seen where pressure has worked. Some of the countries which wanted to pass very offensive laws and pressure prevailed, and the countries had to abandon such initiatives. So let's not overlook pressure from the international community.
Thank you. I just wanted to let everybody know the third committee is coming back here at 3, so we actually have about 10 more minutes, and we can take a few questions in that time. And before I go to the floor, I just wanted to exercise a bit of moderator's prerogative on this last question, which is, in our view, no matter what civil society does, there will never be enough civil society to monitor the world in this area. And that is why we try to emphasize the importance of rules, standards, and due diligence on the part of governments, companies, and multilateral organizations to to not just police themselves, but to be accountable for it. Because as much as civil society can do, and it can do more, it will never be the solution to this issue. So I just say that while there's plenty to do, there rules are always helpful in this regard as well. But with that, I saw somebody in the back there that had a question, so I'll go right there.
Thank you very much. My name is Sally Dunn, and I am an NGO representative here at the UN. I represent the Loreto Committee. And my NGO is a member of the Working Group on Mining, consisting of a number of NGOs who are quite concerned about these very issues that we're discussing. So our advocacy work here at the UN consists of advocating for a human rights-based approach to the extractives development model. And I'm quite interested in hearing comments from the panel about a concern that I think all of us on the mining working group here would have, and that is that we believe that in the consultation phase, in the planning phase for some of these major projects, there is a room for consideration of the potential human rights violations that a major project would inflict on local peoples. And we believe that there are times when the human rights considerations need to outweigh the economic or development potential benefits of a project and determine that that project should not be pursued. And I guess I'm interested to know, do you all know of any cases where that has indeed happened, where the violation of human rights was deemed to be simply unacceptable? Usually, all we talk about is what are companies going to do to try to minimize the human rights violations or to try to mitigate or compensate for. But we believe very strongly that human rights violations are something that should be a stop sign to some of these major developments, and I'd like to know your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've just learned they need the room a little bit sooner than possible, so what I'm going to do is ask if Pavel has an answer to this question, and then we'll have to wrap it up, unfortunately.
Я думаю, что, конечно же, права человека являются как бы священной коровой, да, и, конечно, было бы очень важно, чтобы никто не нарушал эти права. Однако жизнь сегодня показывает, что это, к сожалению, далеко не так. И я думаю, то, что чем вы занимаетесь, да, и чем, в принципе, занимаемся и мы, это как раз все-таки движение к тому, чтобы нарушение прав человека, но если не совсем ликвидировать, то свести к минимуму. Естественно, ну, опять же, я хотел бы подчеркнуть, что ну, наша задача, да, чтобы искоренить все нарушения прав человека. Ну, жизнь показывает, что этот процесс очень долгий и сложный. И я, в принципе, также считаю, что если какой-то проект нарушает права человека, то, ну, вот исходя из моей личной гражданской позиции, я считал бы, что такой проект необходимо было бы останавливать. Здесь вот уже по предыдущему вопросу говорилось о том, что компании являются крупными налогоплательщиками и так далее, и так далее, и поэтому из-за каких-то общин коренных народов эти проекты никто не будет останавливать, но надо же понимать, а эти общины коренных народов, их не очень много по численности, но они что, не граждане этой страны? Они что, не являются такими же людьми, как и другие граждане страны, что ли? Поэтому я считаю, что в любом случае, да, в каждом конкретном случае надо подходить отдельно. При этом, по моему мнению, конечно же, надо исключать эти нарушения.
Thank you very much. We are We will need to wrap up now just because of the time pressure. So I just wanted to thank all of our panelists who've taken the time today and thank the Government of Norway and the International Service for Human Rights for organizing this session. And thanks to all of you, both in the room and online, who participated and asked questions. Thank you again.